We are trying to make it easier for you to have kids because we're taking the side of babies, which is another way of saying we are pro-human.
Welcome to Act in Line, a product of the Acton Institute for the Study of Religion and Liberty. I'm Eric Cohn, executive producer. Our current culture tells parents that there's one best way to raise kids. Enroll them in a dozen activities, protect them from trauma, and get them into the most expensive college you can. If you can't do that, don't even bother. How's that going? Record rates of anxiety, depression, medication, debts, loneliness, and more. In his new book, Family Unfriendly, How Our Culture Made Raising Kids Much Harder Than It Needs to Be, bestselling author and Washington Examiner columnist Timothy P. Carney says it's time to end this failed experiment in overparenting. Have more kids, have more fun, cancel the travel soccer games, let your kids wander off, and give them deeper sources of meaning than material success. This is an old-fashioned view, but every day the evidence validates it. Drawing on rigorous research, both as a reporter and as a dad of six, Carney demonstrates why modern parenting is so misguided. The high standards set for modern American parenting are unrealistic and setting parents and our kids up to fail. So what can be done about all of this? Well, Tim Carney has plenty of ideas. I talked to him today about parenting, overparenting, how and why society became so family unfriendly, and what can and should be done about it. You can find additional resources in the show notes for this episode, as well as find previous episodes of Act in Line on our website at acton.org/actinline. And if you like this program, you can help us reach even more listeners by sharing it with a friend and leaving us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. We welcome your comments as well. Act in Line is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Timothy P. Carney is a father of six children, a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, and a columnist at the Washington Examiner. Tim and his wife, Katie, have raised their family in suburban Maryland and northern Virginia. Tim grew up with three older brothers in Greenwich Village and later Pelham, New York. He is the author of Alienated America, The Big Ripoff, and Obamanomics. His latest book is Family Unfriendly, How Our Culture Made Raising Kids Much Harder Than It Needs to Be, which we'll be discussing today. Tim Carney, welcome to Act in Line.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So your book is Family Unfriendly, How Our Culture Made Raising Kids Much Harder Than It Needs to Be. What made you decide to write this book?
Well, part of it was just watching how our culture was retreating from marriage and family formation. You know, marriage rates are low and falling. Birth rates hit record lows even before the pandemic. We went from about 2.1 babies per woman when my wife and I had our first kid down to below 1.7 in 2019. And it's been a steady fall at a time when the number of births should have been going up because the millennials were coming onto the scene. And so I realized something was wrong. The economy was recovering and people weren't getting married. They weren't having kids. So there was a deeper root. And as a political reporter, I get to travel all over the country, ask people questions. So I started asking them, you know, what are your thoughts on marriage? Why aren't your kids getting married and having kids? Why are you going to get married and have kids? And slowly started to realize that the pure economic explanations for the retreat from marriage and family formation didn't do the trick, that there was a cultural illness. And parents were telling me this too. They're saying, I feel like it's harder to raise kids today than it was for our parents and our grandparents. And I think that's true. So to sort out what in our culture is sick, to what extent the economics are the explanation, to what extent policy can or can't help, that's why I wrote Family Unfriendly.
So how did we get here? You know, I don't think that, at least as I see it, I don't think there were a lot of people who set out with the objective of making it more difficult from a policy perspective to form families. But nonetheless, the trends are the trends. So what did you see? What did you hear as you talked to people? How did we end up in this current situation?
Well, so one way to tell this story is to remark on the fact that the baby boom was totally unexpected. Birth rates had kind of been falling, and we thought we were going to settle around just above what demographers call the replacement rate, 2.1 babies per woman. And then the guys came home for more, and boom, it wasn't just a makeup for the babies that didn't happen during the war. It was this sort of massive, unexpected, generation-long increase in family formation. And then, so then to ask, what has changed since, you know, 1960, when that all sort of the number of births sort of peaked there? Well, a lot has changed. And so that's one way to ask the question. And so I think that one thing was, you could blame kind of our love of efficiency and a certain sort of modern capitalism, that small towns where kids could run around and ride their bikes been replaced by sprawling suburbs where your parents have to drive you everywhere. That really matters. This was not, again, some anti-child conspiracy, but it was valuing sort of economic efficiency over community strength and family formation. A lot of other things. Workism. Work is good, right? But our culture, our school system has driven, sometimes out of a misguided feminism, has sort of driven home the idea, well, you really have to be, you know, engaged in hustle culture and climbing the ladder and signing up for all these activities and getting into college. So then, A, the parents are run ragged by their travel sports and all the enrichment and violin lessons. And B, children come to see sort of their own achievements professionally, academically, as a source of their value. And that's not a mindset that's oriented towards family formation. So these cultural changes, a lot of which were related to kind of good ideas of, you know, let's build a new modern kind of town. Let's make sure that people, men and women, boys and girls, are pursuing their career success. These were just two of the many cultural changes that made raising kids harder and seemingly less attractive to a lot of people.
So, I mean, where do you think this cultural shift comes from, right? So like if you had baby boomers mm-hmm. who, you know, their parents obviously, you know, believed in family formation and having kids, and you have baby boomers, which I don't recall hearing, but if you have something from what you researched for the book about, you know, kind of a decline over time in the baby boom generation, the boomers themselves, in terms of their family formation, what really were the cultural forces that brought us here? Like, why does I'm an older millennial. You know, like where did we change our focus from families to a lot of the things that you were just describing? You know, we could talk about things like economic efficiency and all of that, but it kind of seems like these cold and partial forces of the world are driving us in this direction, not of our choosing. But it was people actively making different choices.
Yep.
How did we end up there?
So sometimes I talk about sort of a spirit of the age and the spirit of those post-war years when people were forming families, getting married much younger, having more kids. The spirit then was optimism and hope in the United States. Look over at Germany in the three decades after World War II. Guess what? They hit among the lowest birth rates in the world, as did Italy and Japan. So one interpretation of this is that the idea that we are good kind of peaked in the years after World War II. We had just saved the world from like Hitler and came back, and the women had kept the economy running, and we believed in our own goodness. And I think that as we have secularized as a culture, you're old enough to remember that there was this sort of celebration in the end of the Bush era and beginning of the Obama era that like the religious right had been defeated because fewer and fewer people are going to church or synagogue or mosque, and that, you know, Catholic guilt was going to get wiped out and we're all going to be happier. And in a more secular world, it turns out that we have a lower view of ourselves. We have a lower view of humanity, especially if the only sort of ways we can see goodness is individual achievement. It's very easy to see that that is either fleeting or inadequate. And so, I mean, this is the final chapter of Family Unfriendly is about our goodness and the fact that our culture today, especially the sort of elite, the culturally dominant sort of elite minority, doesn't see humans as good. And I really think that that's a big change in the second half of the 20th century. And it goes hand in hand with our hyper-individualism. It's easy to see a hyper-individualism as a celebration of a great man and human achievement. And often it is. But when it goes too far, it becomes the opposite. It becomes this sort of atomizing force. This idea where we really are kind of have a darker understanding of ourselves. And I think that these devices are part of the problem. We stare into these black mirrors of social media. And so that, if I were to nail down a root cause, and this is what I try to argue in Family and Friendly that I don't think other people have, I think it's a civilizational sadness, a lack of a belief that we are good. That makes it harder to raise children because you don't trust other people. It makes it less likely that you're going to want children. If we're not good, why make more of us?
What changed our mind about the goodness of people? I mean, if you chart it against kind of events in the world at the time that this attitude was shifting, you know, even just in my mm-hmm. lifetime, you know, the 1980s, we had come out of, you know, a really bad period in the United States in the 1970s. The 1980s, you have the, you know, the mourning in America kind of attitude. Things seem to be getting better. Into the early 1990s, you have the fall of the Soviet Union, you know, the mm-hmm. end of history, as Fukuyama says. And the 90s were this incredible boom period of time. You have, you know, the dot-com boom. The economy was going really well. Things seemed to be really good in the 90s. And perhaps 9/11 is, you know, I often have wondered about the scar that 9/11 left on the American culture, but I don't know that I
See,
would
I,
rush
I think
to
an
point
important
to that.
Thing, I mean, I think that it left a different impact on people my age. I'm about your age. I'm a young Gen Xer. I was out of college when 9/11 happened, and I saw this was a horrible thing. I lost high school friends. It was a reminder of the fragility of human life and the existence of evil. None of those things are the same as showing us, as making us think that we are bad. Now, when you look at people who were younger millennials, the reaction to 9/11, which was to just promulgate distrust. You have to take off your shoes and your belt at the airport. The driving home the idea that terrorism is a constant threat, that anybody next to you might be a terrorist. I think that the people who sort of just absorb the post 9/11 counterterrorism mindset, they're getting more of a dose of that humanity is bad rather than evil exists. The humanity is bad and you shouldn't trust anyone mindset. And so bad things happening is not the same as, you know, what you would call trauma is not the same as civilizational sadness, in my view. There's people right now who say they are anticipating an Israeli baby boom following the October 7th attacks. And so you'll get demographic numbers later in 2024 about whether or not that's true. You had after slavery, it was more likely for former slaves and their descendants to have children than it was for former slave owners. So the belief in our badness can't be chalked up to something bad happening to us. I think does it create a sense of distrust of all your fellow men? I think when you look around and at other people where you see a reflection of yourself, that's the question. And to me, I would say that it's, again, I'm going to go back to secularization. I think that when we have a materialistic view of the world, it can start off seeming like fun and hedonism, but it progressively becomes this sad, atomistic, dog-eats-dog mindset. So look at the decline of church attendance and religious affiliation. I think that has a direct cause to our civilizational sadness.
You could take this next question as an invitation to comment more on the decline in religiosity, but I remember having a conversation on this podcast with David Bahnsen maybe a year and a half ago or so, where one of the things we talked about was a lack of understanding of eschatology and an idea of, you know, what comes beyond this world. Which I think is, I think, definitely tied into the secularization and the lack of religiosity. But I'm wondering if you've seen anything to suggest that the lack of our thinking of what comes beyond our existence in from the time we are born until the time that we die kind of leads us to be nihilistic about the idea of having kids, which, you know, sustains some part of us beyond our existence on this planet. I wonder if you could tie these things together, if that's, you know, that the lack of thinking about what comes after we're not here anymore leads us to be more cynical and less interested in the people who are going to be here after we're not here anymore.
No, I think that's right. And I imagine among our listeners today, there's probably dozens of people who are better able to talk about the anthropological effects of bad eschatology. But I do think I focus in Family and Friendly more on just sort of the bad anthropology, the view of human beings as good because of their achievements rather than human beings as ends in themselves. And the bad, it doesn't just show up sort of in hyper-achievement talk, but in the description of children as a consumer choice is one of the bigger ways that it shows up. And so that's a way, I mean, I try to phrase it, I try to use the talk of the future that you're referring to beyond our lives as a way to appeal to the secular reader and say, well, we shouldn't just treat children as just another consumer choice because they really are the future. Now, then I started to sound like those cheesy songs from the 1980s. I believe the children are the future. And so my aversion to cheesy talk kept me from really hammering home that point. But I really do. You see, you know, the Wall Street Journal will carry an op-ed saying a child tax credit is like a puppy tax credit or Tesla tax credit, that it's rewarding certain choices over others and the tax code should be neutral to that. And I started thinking about it and I thought, you know what? I used to believe in neutrality and I still do believe in a lot of neutrality. But on this question, if we're neutral about people or not people, then that's a real bad anthropology. To treat children and babies as a consumer choice is a real bad anthropology. So the way I try to do the argument about how a supernatural worldview versus a materialistic worldview matters is not by looking at eschatology, but instead at looking at anthropology. When you look at another person, do you see either a means to an end? Do you see a mouth that will consume resources? A better and still kind of materialistic answer, but still good and true, is do you see a mind and hands that will produce value, which is historically what humans are? But an even better argument, though, is regardless of what is consumed or eaten or produced, do you see something of infinite value made in the image of God that is an end in itself? And I really think you have to have something close to that Christian anthropology, which is present as well in the other Abrahamic faiths. You have to have something to that anthropology in order to really, in this modern economy, justify having children, especially a large family.
I do want to come back to the economy in a moment here, but we're recording this conversation a bit in advance of the release of your book. And I'm sure by the time people hear this, either what I'm about to reference will be completely forgotten or will have completely come around again as a social media thing. But I only yesterday learned the term DINK. Dual income, no kids.
Oh, yeah.
It was this video of two people celebrating all the things that they're able to do as dual income earners with no kids. Like, we can decide to fly off to Europe on a moment's notice or just go down to Florida for fun. And there is evidence of this kind of celebration of the idea of not having children, both as what I think you just referenced, which is just a choice right? That, you know, there's a very libertarian argument that, like, these are just different choices that people make, and there is no evaluation to be made of the goodness or the badness, or at least how, mm-hmm. you know, the different elements of those choices. And it's also built up in this kind of social media celebration of people who are doing these kinds of things, that it's like they're focusing on themselves, that they're taking care of themselves without an obligation to somebody else. So maybe this is just an example of the kind of phenomenon that you're talking about and that you've observed and written about in this book.
Yeah, so it's tricky because I had this great conversation, great as in very telling conversation, in Utah. So I went to this neighborhood in Salt Lake City that I thought would be super family friendly, but its proximity to the university and something about the niceness of it has caused it to be bid up among non-families. So I'm walking around looking for families, and it turns out that in the what's called the Avenues part of Salt Lake City, there were very few families. And the first couple I run into is late 20s, and I say I'm writing about families, marriage, birthrates. They say, "Oh, we're probably not having kids." And then one of them says, "Oh, we're definitely not having kids." Their names were Isaac and Nicole. And I said, "Oh, why not?" And he said, "Well, they're too expensive." And I said, "How?" And he said, "Well, in every way." And then he catches himself. He says, "If I'm going to be honest, we're just selfish. I always say to Nicole, somebody else is cleaning up vomit while watching Teletubbies, and we're going to be having margaritas in Paris." And I will always remember that line, margaritas in Paris. I wish I had gotten to correct them, that if they do get to go to Paris, to skip the margaritas, but I didn't get to. But so those two explanations of it's too expensive and people are too selfish are both wholly unsatisfactory to me, because one, the expensiveness, the unaffordability of raising children has barely gone up, and only really in the last couple of years because housing prices went up. The birth rate was collapsing long before we had Biden inflation and housing going crazy during COVID. But also selfishness, I think, has been flat and level since approximately the moment that Adam and Eve ate the apple. I think that humans are not more selfish. What we do is we set up civilization and culture in order to combat selfishness, in order to try to align the individual's interests with the common good, in order to try to align individual's short-term interests with their long-term good. And so our culture somehow isn't playing that role anymore. So when you look at the Dink video, and it's actually a pretty common theme on social media, but when you look at these videos of, oh, we have such a great life because we don't have to worry about kids, one of the things I note is, well, people have always had those incentives. And there's something about our culture now, part of it is social media celebrating it, where people aren't kind of shaken out of it. A more important thing, though, is it used to be that there wasn't so much a strong counter argument against the sort of hedonistic, live your own life however you want without any demands on your time. There was just cultural expectations. Are you a grown-up? Well, you're probably going to get married. And if you get married, you're going to have kids. Unless you're called to, you know, I'm a Catholic. I think some of my favorite people are called to lives of celibacy and childlessness. So unless you have another vocation to something else, then you're just sort of expected to have kids. Once marriage and kids becomes a deliberate choice that's part of living intentionally, and it should always be a choice. It should always be individually chosen, discerned as a vocation. But once we remove those expectations, that's, I think, what changes a lot of the culture.
There's something about those kinds of videos as well that leaves me a little skeptical. And to an extent, I don't want to doubt the sincerity of the people who are expressing that kind of, you know, Dink point of view in these videos. Although I think sincerity is a much overrated virtue, I kind of wonder, especially given what you referenced earlier about technology and social media, that there certainly does seem to be a performative element to it, where it strikes me as almost like, are you trying to convince me or are you trying to convince yourself that this is exactly the kind of lifestyle that not only you should be living, but that other people should be living? Did you pick up on any like sense of that of the people who make those kinds of, you know, margaritas in Paris arguments are, you know, a bit doth protest too much, and like, are they trying to persuade themselves of the righteousness of their choice?
I mean, again, that's a psychology question. I'm not sure I'm equipped to ask, but the sadness, like, again, margaritas in Paris, is not a good one. Guy I interviewed in Iowa said, well, we really want to be able to travel, not that we do travel much. And then the Dink video, like there was no idea of sort of service to others or contribution to community. It was also self-oriented. And like the nice thing they did was that they get to order appetizers and desserts at dinner. Like, it wasn't that that exciting at all. And the other side of it, I mean, parents are some of the worst offenders in creating unreal social media. The mama sphere, the mommy bloggers, I think is a horrible and ultimately an anti-family force, because you get these people who present this perfect lifestyle and their kids are perfectly behaved and perfectly groomed, but they trick you by making it look like it's all just easy. I call it the affect of ease. And some of these perfect pictures, like the boys are outside in just their socks, which as a parent, you know, like go barefoot or put on shoes, but they really want to go out in just their socks. So that's just like identifiably like kid thing to do. But then everything else about the whole picture is perfect. And you notice that the mommy bloggers are always in like a farmhouse, so that it can look rustic, but it's obviously like everything about it, like the exposed rafters show that it's all just natural and we're so relaxed, but everything is perfectly oriented. The accent wall matches mom's eyes, right? And so that aspect of social media, I think, is possibly even more corrosive than the celebration of the Dinks, precisely because of what you're saying. The Dinks aren't that convincing. We don't look at them and say, oh, I want that lifestyle. But you might look at the mommy bloggers and say, I could never be that put together. I think that's what you have to do to be a parent. So one of the things I try to do in Family and Friendly is point out that I lose my kids all the time. Like, I go out, I take them out in public and I lose them. And that one of the things I try to drive home in, you know, my involvement in my community and in my book is that parents need to be able to ignore their kids and have lower ambitions for their kids. That is lower worldly ambitions for their kids. And so to try to drive home, you know what, parenting doesn't have to be as hard as our modern culture, especially some of these mommy bloggers, make it out to be.
Yeah, the old idea of, you know, keeping up with the Joneses only becomes more amplified when the people that you're comparing yourself to aren't just your neighbors or people you go to church or synagogue with or interact with in your community. But, you know, to borrow from Christine Rosen, the downside of social media is that it has all of the negative qualities of small town living with none of the positive qualities. So things that happen thousands of miles away from you feel like they're in your backyard. So you've just expanded this universe of people that you could compare yourself to with, you know, and I think while people understand what you were just saying about like how these things are kind of staged and presented to look in a certain way, I do think that like kind of implicitly we understand that, but like we somehow lie to ourselves to think that like, well, I also have to meticulously curate my life. It's, you know, like the joke I used to make about a friend of mine who, you know, spent 20 minutes in the morning styling his hair so as to look like he just got out of bed. It's kind of the same thing to me of like people who are meticulously curating their lives to make it look like they just, yeah, it all happens this way.
Spontaneous moment. Yes. Yeah. And yeah. And so we intellectually can understand that these moments are curated, but emotionally we can't. I've had people make sort of evolutionary psychology arguments that, you know, that comparison to others is a good survival trait in a normal human level scale. But when it's, as you're saying, we're comparing ourselves to a select number of people out of the 8 billion people on Earth, then that inhumane social comparison becomes a net negative. And so, I mean, I've combed through a ton of papers. You know, I'm an AI scholar, and so the sociology papers, I combed through a lot of them. And I was surprised at how many, when they looked at social media, found that the the positive images were more likely to make you sad than the negative images on social media. And it's just envy. You're seeing this curated, even if not curated in stage, somebody caught like the best moment of their day on camera. And that's the moment they post on Instagram. And in your mind, you might think, oh, that's great. I'm glad they had that moment. But then in your mind, you're like, most of my day was doing boring stuff, trying to get my kids to not go outdoors in their socks, or, you know, thinking about the fact that Davey is failing Algebra 1 for the second time. And that comparison that mostly happens on a subconscious level makes us sad. And again, I think that that is a family unfriendly force that social media inflicts on us.
To what extent do you think, I've made this argument with regard to politics and, you know, some of the things downstream from that, that, you know, social media, I think there are definitely problems there, but you know, we kind of forget how young it actually is and how short of a period of time, mm-hmm. all considered, we've been living with it. And to a great extent, we just, you know, we had to learn how to adapt to the existence of the television and the radio and the printing press. And these things took a lot more time. And getting back to, you know, the point about being impatient with the idea of, you know, the span of time that things will come beyond ourselves. We want it to be fixed and we want it to be good right now. To what extent do you think, you know, with regards to these social media problems, it hasn't been around long enough. We haven't really figured out how to live with it yet, and that we will make these kinds of adjustments. We're just not there yet.
Yeah. So this is definitely something I've thought about for years, that social media is a technological shock, and that right now it's a net negative, but there are positives, and in the long run it can become a net positive. I put that a little above 50% 5 years ago. My last book, Alienated America, maybe you were the one who floated that idea past me. And I said, that seems plausible. Now I'm more negative on it, except for this. If we learn to govern ourselves and our use of this better, then it can be a net positive. So for instance, the people who were 5 years old when their parents first got an iPhone. So people born in like 2000, 2001. Then when they were 10, their parents handed down their old second generation iPhone, and then boom, they had unlimited access. So the kids who are now 23 probably had the most unregulated exposure to apps and social, or certainly smartphones and apps, than anybody else. Most parents of children who were born, you know, in 2005 and later have thought, okay, there's dangers here. We don't just give a phone to a kid and think it's only upsides. We know that there are downsides. The sort of dumb phones that are optimized for kids, there's one called a Gab, there's one called a Pinwheel, there's a third one out whose name I forget. These devices are developed in the recent years. It's recently that parents are starting to say, okay, I want to give my kids the upsides of the phones without the downsides. So that is, we are becoming smarter. The private Catholic schools where I send my children, most of them have always banned smartphones. But now you have public schools banning all cell phones in the building. This is, again, us learning to regulate it. And so that's going to be part of it, is a cultural regulation of it. And again, this I talk about the culture again and again in this book. Parents themselves trying to say you can't have social media are up against a horrible fight. Oh, my friends, the only way they communicate is by InstaChat, da-da-da-da-da-da. You send your kids to a school that bans smartphones in the building, it's easy to say, you don't need a smartphone. Why do you need a smartphone? And guess what? Don't tell me all your friends have smartphones, because I know half of them don't. And so that's the culture supporting parents who want to resist the smartphone and social media.
You mentioned a little while ago the kind of worldly aspirations that people have, parents have for their kids, the people who are having children, and this being one of the things that puts pressure on parents. I remember listening to an interview with Brian Kaplan, who had an interesting book of Selfish Reasons to Have More Kids, which was kind of the, I felt a little resistant to his argument, because in a way I didn't want it to be true. I've got two kids myself. They're like, his argument, you know, I may be doing a bit of a disservice to, is kind of like, you don't have that much of an impact on your children in terms of, like, you know, if you do these things and they're going to, you know, grow up to be the next Isaac Newton or something. So take some pressure off of yourself. And I thought maybe it went a little far in the sense of, like, it kind of almost argued that, like, you're irrelevant to this. And I don't think that was Brian's point. You're not irrelevant to the lives of your children, but there's certainly, you can see this in, you know, we're close enough in age and know enough people who are parents that you see that kind of pressure that people will put on themselves about the achievement of their children. You know, where do you think this cultural shift came from?
So absolutely. And this is the first two chapters of my book. The first one is about the travel team trap, and the second one is about helicopter parenting. And my wife and I were sort of insulated against some of it because we have six children. So you just can't do all the stuff that you think you should do. And it becomes clear that we don't have to. But that's not to say we don't, you know, stress too much about their academics or think that, oh, if we spend more time with them or get them the right tutor, then they can bump up to an A in math and that'll be important so they can get into the right college. All of that stuff really pervades. There's this horrible term that sociologists use, which is they describe the demographic transition since 1970, the collapse in U.S. birth rates and the birth rates in the Western world, as being parents are choosing quality over quantity. That is, people who used to have eight kids just had a bunch of kids and let them run. And now you have two kids and you're really supporting them in every way. And there are ways in which giving each kid individualized attention has massive upsides. I love it when I get to spend one-on-one time with my kid. I think it's fun. I think in the long run, it builds bonds, you know, and if there's something they're interested in, you know, one kid, I hit him a bunch of fly balls and he becomes a better outfielder. Great. But that has been taken to an extreme in our culture. And now we think that what we owe our children, especially because it was a choice, right? Nobody expected us, made us. We're writing our own life script. We deliberately, in our intentional living, decided to have these two children. So now we have to make sure that they are as successful as possible. So I think that comes, again, from secularization, which exacerbates a sort of materialistic, utilitarian view of the individual. And then from shrinking families itself, it drives the idea that, well, if I have one or two kids, I have to give them everything, which then drives shrinking families, which then drives that idea. So I think a lot of the cultural shifts since the sexual revolution, the birth control pill, secularization of America have been towards this maximum effort parenting. And it isn't quality parenting because the kids and the parents both end up much more stressed out and depressed.
What you referenced there of people thinking of quality over quantity, to what extent are you concerned about evolutions in medical technology, our understanding of genetics and the possibility of, you know, beyond the, we're going to have one or two kids and we're going to, you know, do everything that we can to maximize the potential outcomes that they have in their lives, to getting into the idea of selecting qualities of those children through some kind of, you know, genetic manipulation. Considering the nature of the conversation at this point, strikes me as the kind of thing that would exacerbate these kinds of problems and only make people more interested in directly curating the exact kind of child you're going to have and how they're going to be and who they are and what they're going to do, rather than the kind of joy of parenting, which is finding out who these human beings you created are and what they're interested in.
There will certainly be huge demand for this because of what you're describing. The modern mindset just wants to plan everything. And life itself being fertile is inherently messy. And we have this sort of antibiotic, pro-sterile mindset towards what the good and safe life is. And that's why you have fewer kids. That's why you avoid taking risks. And just having a child, though, every single child is unplanned because you might have planned to have a child at this exact time. And it still is not a person you really got to choose. I describe in Family and Friendly, one of the weirdest moments as a parent was the first moment. We'd been so ready for our daughter. We named her after my mom, was named after my grandma, you know, going way back. We had decorated her nursery. We had decided ahead of time that a certain color that would go with each child. And it wasn't just going to be pink and blue. She had this bright green room. And I had even joked that we were going to give them numbers, like uniform numbers, that she was going to get the number 42. We were totally ready for this child. She's born. And I look at her and my first thought is, who is this person? I've never met her in my life. I now have a best friend for life and a roommate for 20 years. And I've never met her before. What the heck are we doing? And so that unchosenness, as you put it beautifully, like finding out who they are. And then with each kid being different, I mean, we had a girl and then a boy, and then we had a boy. And I thought those second boy was going to be like the first boy, and he was totally different. And this was sort of, and I was stupid enough to be surprised by that, right? but that's again part of the joy and the crazy things they say. One of the people I quote in my book, I say going for a walk with a 4-year-old is like going for a walk with Wadsworth, or it was some other poet. I remember my daughter being like, Look at the plane. Isn't that so cool? Wow, there's a plane. And you're like, planes go overhead all the time. And then you're thinking, no, that's really cool. There's a plane. Why are these leaves different, Dad? I only learned about leaves because my daughter was like, why do these leaves look different? They notice things that your mind, your rational, old, ossified mind don't notice. They fertilize our world by existing. And that unexpectedness is exactly what our modern mind thinks that we can conquer with science, right? And so the idea that we should be able to craft our child, not just boy or girl, but other things about it, it will certainly have massive demand and will certainly, I think, exacerbate our civilizational sadness. Because once you've made a person and crafted them exquisitely, you expect them to serve a certain purpose. I spent months making a dining room table for my wife. If we couldn't sit at that table and eat dinner, it would have been a waste, right? If you gene edit your child and they don't turn out the way you expected, well, then you're going to think, what the heck is this kid? It's going to be harder to see them as a good in themselves.
You reminded me of one of my favorite commercials from, it might be as long as 10 years ago now, but I think it was a diaper commercial, but you know, this family is packing a stroller's first child, and they're packing the stroller with everything they could ever possibly need in going out into the world. And they fast forward, second child has got the kid in the arms, they grab a handful of Cheerios and they walk out the door. And there is something about going through that first child experience that disabuses you of a yes. lot of the overpreparedness that you bring to the table for the first. Or I think in most cases it does, and it kind of relaxes you to the, yes. We don't have to be nearly as neurotic as we thought we had to be in the very beginning there. Connect this book, if you can, to I've recommended to a lot of people your last book, Alienated America. I thought along with Charles Murray's Coming Apart and Jonah Goldberg's Suicide of the West was one of my like three most important books for understanding the political epoch that we've been living through. What through lines can you connect between what you learned and experienced in reporting and writing Alienated America that connect to Family Unfriendly?
Mm-hmm. Well, I thought the most important... So Alienated America was about the collapse of community. And as your reference to Charles Murray makes clear that this was especially acute in the working class. And I thought the one of the most profound negative effects of the collapse of community was the retreat from marriage and the decline of the birth rate. That was chapter five in Alienated America. And then the very end of the book, where I sort of craft what a stronger future community could be like, it ends like a, I think I was thinking of a Shakespearean comedy. It ought to end in a wedding. It ends with a vision of me sort of walking my daughter down the aisle of the church, and that's the heart of our community, and her getting married and starting her own family. And so in some ways, Family Unfriendly is a sequel to Alienated America, that a key thing. And I actually repeat a title of a chapter from Alienated America as a title of a chapter in Family Unfriendly. And that's, it takes a village. Hillary used this term. And so conservatives, you know, assume she means like the government's going to take your kids from them. And then we look at Fairfax County, Loudoun County public schools, and we know what they mean. But that doesn't take away from the fact that it does, in fact, take a community to build a family, that we need mentors. We need places, institutions to belong to where we can meet people, mentors to show us what marriage is, mentors to show us what family is, babysitters for our kids. We need people who are role models, who show us, okay, wait, there's light at the end of the tunnel when the kids are in the terrible twos, which are really the terrible threes for any of you new parents out there. But that collapse of community is at the heart of it. And the reason that people think, oh, we need new government policies, or we need this new massive handout, or we need government-sponsored daycare, is because of alienation, that we come to think that the individual and the state are the only, this is what Tocqueville predicted, right? The individual and the state are the only two things that a lot of people can see. So if they say, I can't handle this, my wife and I can't handle this on ourselves, they then turn to the state. Another way of phrasing it is they think that the market and the government are the only two providers of goods. I can't afford a nanny, so I need government provided stuff. The idea that some of us rely on our neighbors, our parents, our siblings, our in-laws, etc., is lost to the alienated mind. And so you read these things, it costs $250,000 to raise a kid, yada, yada. You realize that that's paying for everything. A lot of parents get help from their own parents, their own in-laws, their own community. They don't pay for everything. There's a local library that's not, you know, built and funded explicitly to be a child care center, but it's a place you can bring a kid. There's a local park. There's neighbors who will look after your kids. There's a neighborhood basketball court where the kids spend all day. So you're not paying for daycare during the summer every day. And so that alienation, not only is that is one of the main things that makes America's culture family unfriendly, it also is part of the reason that we're not focused on the actual solutions, because we don't even see civil society as a potential source of these goods.
You know, I'm going to take a guess here, and in keeping with the quip from Bill Buckley to George Will about writing, how am I going to write two columns a week, and there'll be two things every week that will annoy you, and you'll write about those things. I'm going to take a guess, Tim, that you, as somebody with a number of kids and living where you live, made some personal observations about the environment, the community, mm-hmm. the culture in which you were living that, you know, made it obvious to you that, like, this makes having children and raising children more difficult. What were those things that you observed that really had an influence on your life that made raising a family more difficult?
All right, if I'm going to give the top three, number one is I let my son try out for a travel baseball team because COVID had canceled this championship game and the tryouts for the next day, and he wanted baseball, and it was a beautiful weekend in November, and I thought he would get cut. He made the team. And then they told us about, you know, January winter workout, some ice storm night and some indoor baseball facility. And, you know, so now my family is having dinner without me, without Charlie. My wife has to put all the kids to bed. Charlie walks out. And I said, how was it? He said, Dad, the first thing coach said was baseball isn't fun. Winning baseball is fun. This is to a 12-year-old boy. And I call Katie, I say, So the bad news is we made a mistake and we already paid for it. The good news is every horrible thing that happens, I think it can go in this book that I want to write. So that was number one, the crazy schedule pulling us in every direction, the taking away the fun of childhood, the orienting it so that anything was only worth our time if we had measurable success in it. That was definitely something I wanted to overcome. Where I used to live in Maryland, I just moved over to Virginia a couple of years ago. But when I lived in Maryland, my kids, we had bought a house that backed up to a playground which and a ball field, and that was great. Anywhere else they wanted to go, basically, they needed to cross seven lanes of roads. Montgomery County, which is, you know, we're pro-climate, we're et cetera. They built everything for cars rather than for people. This sounds like a small thing. Walkability is something, you know, is it just people with Fitbits who care about it? Is it libs who hate cars who care about it? No. Every parent can tell you that having to drive their kids everywhere and having to worry about their kids get run over by cars everywhere is a number one source of stress. We Gen Xers, we used to ride our bike everywhere. If you've seen the beginning of Stranger Things, that sort of opening scene of the kids riding their bike, and this is what we did. Sometimes they said on a school night, they said, be home when the streetlights come on. That liberation of our childhood compared to how the built environment built for cars and so much of suburban America is enslaving for kids and thus for parents was definitely another part of it. And then again, just talking to people who are mostly millennials and Gen Z, who is part of my job, who are just sad about the future. And that was an experience. I guess it's not a parenting experience, but a professional experience, realizing that that was really a motivator for it. And it then made me sad for them. If you want to be less sad about the future, have kids, but the sadness about the future gets in the way of their having kids.
Your second point there was very much driven home to me. My wife and I had lived in Chicago, and you know, you get this a lot with, you know, where are you from? Chicago. Where? Oh, like, you know, Downers Grove or something. Like, no, we lived in the city of Chicago. And when we were considering moving up to Grand Rapids, where I am now, I came and I was looking at houses, and driving into East Grand Rapids where we live, there's going into it for the first time, coming down the main street, there's a couple of kids about my daughter's age who are walking the dog by themselves, and a couple of kids about my son's age who are riding bikes on their own. And it was just the kind of thing that, for everything that we loved about living in the city of Chicago, and there are plenty of things to recommend major cities, that's just not the kind of thing that we could do living in the city of Chicago. Mm-hmm. It's the kind of thing you have to have a certain kind of environment for them to be able to have something comparable to what you described and what I had in my childhood as well, which is the go outside, ride your bikes around. I don't need to know exactly where you are at every given moment. There's also an understanding of a community, right? Like, you know, the neighborhood helps police itself. If the kids are really doing something destructive, exactly, the parents know who the other parents are and they know who to call if they're doing something that they truly should not be doing that moves beyond just the kind of kids being kids kind of problems.
Well, yeah, no. And I talked to a guy who said he was chucking gravel at an old dog. And then suddenly he got yelled at by this woman on the front porch who he didn't know, but he was my age and he was only about a mile from his house. And he realized that even though this woman didn't know his name, there was a good chance that she would figure it out and tell his mom and he would get in big trouble. And that idea of in loco parentis, whatever mom happens to be on the front porch, whatever dad happens to be on the basketball court, gets to discipline you in a limited way and then tell your parents. And that's what's going to happen. Nowadays, if you butt into some other kid's life, you might get called a Karen, right? So we only have two options: totally ignore the kid or call the cops on them, both of which are horrible options. And so that's a sort of societal norm. I still remember when there were stories of parents getting hauled in for leaving their kid. You know, they forgot to leave a key for their kid. The kid came home, can't get in the house, is shooting baskets. It's 90 degrees outside in Arizona. The parents don't come home till 3 hours later. The cops are there waiting for him because an extra neighbor called. And I was listening to a story about this on my local radio station. And multiple callers said that neighbor should have minded her own business. No, that neighbor should have gone out with a glass of ice water and said, do you want to do your homework in my house? Or at least hydrated the kid if you know, inviting into your house is somehow too much of a weird thing to do because neighbors don't know one another. And so that idea of it's normal, once it becomes normal for kids to walk the dogs, then more kids are going to be out walking the dogs and riding their bikes. In my former home county, Montgomery County, Maryland, there was this stretch of a street where there was multiple public schools and public libraries and swimming pools where there was no sidewalk on either side. And when the county said, well, maybe we'll put in a sidewalk, people objected, you're going to kill some trees. And then when somebody said, but the kids need to be able to walk to school alone, one of the neighbors told the local paper, middle school kids shouldn't be walking alone. And so we're choosing trees over children and helicoptering as a societal norm. And that's a truly deeply family unfriendly aspect of our culture.
I don't think people realize too how much you get conditioned by the culture of the places that you live. So again, after having moved from Chicago to Grand Rapids, long story short, shortly after we moved in, you know, we met the people who lived in the house next door to us. And the very next day, it was in the middle of summer around 4th of July, and they invited us over. It's like, you know, we're going to grill. If you want to come over and have dinner, that'd be great. And, you know, I'll be honest, the Chicagoan part of me, the first thing that pops in my head is like, so you're like serial killers, right? Like, we're going to end up underneath the porch or something. And it's like, no, this is just...
Or you're going to proselytize me to your
right,
religion.
Right. Yeah, it's like, no, this is just, you know, the culture of the place that I moved to, which is something that we were seeking in relocating. I lived in plenty of different places in Chicago and really could never say that I knew my neighbors particularly well, but that is manifestly different in the city and the cultural environment that exists in the city that I live now.
And so the neighborhoods that I travel to and write about in the book include, it includes Kemp Mill, a neighborhood in Maryland that's built around two Orthodox synagogues. And so they have to walk to their Sabbath services. So they have to all live within walking distance. And so even if you don't know the name of the neighbor who might live 10 blocks away, there's a sort of, you know who they are. And that just built, I mean, Kemp Mill, people have four or five kids, people who move in there never move out. It's exactly that sort of neighborhood. I went to Israel. I went to Mormon neighborhoods. I also just a block in Falls Church, Virginia, where some of my friends just happened to all buy a house. And so there's tricycles littering the front lawn. And when I've been on that block on a summer afternoon, I was like, this is like summer camp where the counselors aren't really paying attention. it was this beautiful, beautiful world. So writing about those actual neighborhoods and that proximity. And again, the kids are kind of unsupervised, but also any parent who sees something going on can be like, no, that two-year-old is not allowed to be walking out towards the street. That really is a family-friendly culture that's entirely doable in American culture. But to go back to some of the deeper roots early on, if we think other people are inherently bad, then we're not going to form these bonds with our neighbors. If we think of parenting as a totally individualistic undertaking, then we're going to think, oh, those parents are shirking, letting them run around the neighborhood all day, making other people look out for them if something goes wrong. And so those parts of the modern mindset really have to be fixed.
Let's wrap up here. Not all of these kinds of problems can be fixed with public policy choices, but I imagine there are a number of things that have struck you in writing this book that there's some probably low-hanging fruit of some things we could be doing differently that would make communities, that would make life more family-friendly. What are some of those things that have really struck out to you that are the accomplishable, agreeable ones that we could do pretty readily that would make the world, or at least this country, more family-friendly?
I mean, so a local government needs to pave sidewalks, playgrounds, bike trails with the goal of how can kids be liberated and thus liberate adults. So that also includes safety on roads and from crime and that sort of thing. That's all a matter of public policy. You also I think that we need to make sure a lot of it's going to be employers. Employers have to think, how can we allow flexibility for parents? How can we make sure that there's a number of jobs that are 25 hours a week from home for someone who wants to be a stay-at-home mom or dad, but wants to have that income coming in, where they get their kids off to work, sit down at the kitchen table, and then are off the clock by the time the kids come home? That's an employer thing. In places like California, contract work is becoming largely illegal. In other places, you're either part-time or full-time. Some companies never even think about that. How do we make a new parent job for that starts out 10 hours a week and builds up? I think institutions, churches need to think, how can we make send very clearly the message? We're not neutral. Have kids. Bring us kids. Bring them here. Whether it's embracing the crying in at church or setting up a daycare, whichever route you want to take right off of the church, do that. Build a baby box full of gifts and religious paraphernalia and baby necessities and give it to every new baby born in the parish. I mean, I do in the book talk about tax policy and that sort of stuff. I don't think that's the most important stuff. I think we can fix the tax code a little bit, et cetera. And then the most important stuff is the very visible human level messages. We're trying to make it easier for you to have kids because we're taking the side of babies, which is another way of saying we are pro-human.
Tim Carney is a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, where he works on civil society, family, localism, religion in America, economic competition, and electoral politics. He's the author of the new book, Family Unfriendly: How Our Culture Made Raising Kids Much Harder Than It Needs to Be, which we've been discussing today. Tim, thanks so much for joining us today on Act in Line.
Thank you.
As always, thank you for listening. Our team loves putting this podcast together for you. It's encouraging to hear from our listeners. Feedback is incredibly important to us because it lets us know what you'd like to hear more of, including the kinds of topics you're interested in most. If you have comments, feedback, or ideas for a show topic or interesting guest, you can email our team at producer@acton.org. Until next week, for Act in Line, I'm Eric Cohn.